Good afternoon. I'm T. Hetzel, and today on Living Writers, I'm pleased to have in the studio Jeremiah Chamberlain. Jeremy, welcome.
Thank you, T.
I'm so glad that you could come out and be here on this rainy / brilliant, sunny, and strange day that we're having here in Ann Arbor.
Happy to. Thank you.
Without further ado, I'll start with your short bio. Jeremiah Chamberlain received his MFA in creative writing in 2004 from the University of Michigan. Yep, he's one of our own folks, where he now teaches. His writing has appeared in the New York Times Book Review, Poets and Writers, Glimmer Train, Flyway, and the Michigan Quarterly Review, as well as in online exclusives for Granta and the Virginia Quarterly Review. His short fiction is the recipient of a Pushcart Prize special mention, and he has been twice nominated for Best American Voices. He is also a regular contributor to Poets and Writers magazine, which features his interview series inside indie bookstores in each issue. In addition to teaching and writing, he is the editor of Fiction Writers Review, an online literary journal. The site features reviews of new fiction, interviews with fiction writers, and essays on craft and the writing life. They also have a literary blog. So, Jeremy, welcome.
Thanks.
So now we have about a million things to talk about.
Where would you like to start?
I know. Well, let's fill in some of your writer's life biography.
Okay.
When you were a wee lad, when did you start writing? Were you one of those kids that was riding his bike plus writing stories about bugs or what? Take us back in time,
yeah,
Jeremy.
Skateboards and bugs. I was somebody who came to writing fairly early in life. I was in a poetry after-school workshop in third grade with my third-grade writing instructor, Shelley Szymanski, and wrote a poem called Friendship, which stayed on my parents' refrigerator, I think, until I was in graduate school.
Did it have sort of those yellowed edges?
Yes, or it did, exactly. Something about friendship being a bubbling brook, and I'm not quite sure what. But, I really loved writing from a fairly young age. And then because my parents worked at the Interlochen Arts Academy in Northern Michigan, I got to be a faculty brat at that school and got to study writing with some wonderful instructors up there, Mike Delp and Jack Driscoll and Nick Bozanic and Terry Kazat and all sorts of great
people.
Wow,
so when was that, Jeremy?
That was in high school, yeah.
And were most of the other people who were there at the Interlochen Arts
Academy?
Uh-huh. Were they adults or what?
The camp is, Interlochen's most known as a music camp. It's been around for about 100 years, but about 30 years ago, maybe 40 now, they decided to start a boarding school, a private school for about 400 students. It's an international school, and so all disciplines of art are studied there, visual art and dance and theater and music and writing, of course. And there were about 20 of us in the writing program as very eager, very energetic, very, you know, what's the word I'm searching for here? We took ourselves very seriously. wanted to be writers.
Were you wearing berets at the time?
Yes, almost.
Oh, that's great.
But the thing that really had the impact on me, actually, was when I was in high school and I was about 15, Charles Baxter came to Interlochen to give a reading. And while I was in the audience listening to him read one of his stories, probably from his book Through the Safety Net, I'm guessing, I'd have to look back, I literally had one of those transportive experiences that happen at a wonderful reading where you sort of lose sense of time and lose sense of yourself, and you're just completely enthralled in the story. And when he had finished that story, I sort of came back to myself, and I remember very distinctly saying to myself, wherever that guy teaches is where I'm going to go to school, because I really wanted to work with him. And lucky for my parents, it was at Michigan, which meant I got in-state tuition.
And that was for grad school, right,
Jim? That was actually for undergrad.
For undergrad. Yeah. Oh, okay. And then you went to Madison, Wisconsin for a stint?
Yeah, after I had finished my undergraduate and worked very closely with Charlie, who was a wonderful mentor,
It is amazing as an undergraduate to have access to Charlie Baxter, such a great writer.
Yeah, the program is phenomenal. I worked very closely with Charlie and with Eileen Pollack and
yes.
Bill Banco and all those wonderful people.
The Usual Suspects.
The Usual Suspects.
All friends exactly. of the show.
Exactly. And now I get to be with them on the faculty, which is a pleasure. But yeah, afterwards, I knew that I wasn't ready and wouldn't be ready for an MFA program for a long time. The best advice I got from Eileen Pollack was, don't go to an MFA program until you've hit the glass ceiling of your own talents and abilities. To go out into the world and work as hard and as long as it takes you to get as good as you can on your own.
And how did you sense that? Like, how did you know you were reaching up towards the glass ceiling?
Right. Now? Well, I got very lucky in that my best friend at the time and years later, my to-be brother-in-law, Dean Bacopoulos, also a fiction writer, who I met here as an undergraduate, had moved to Madison after he got married and started working at this very small bookstore named Canterbury. Small, independent, specializing in literature, poetry, new fiction, and a small coffee shop attached to it. And a few months after we'd graduated, I guess it was the fall of that year, he said, you know, we have an opening in the store. You ought to move out here. Now, I had assumed after college that the way to be a writer was to move to the wilderness, to isolate oneself like a hermit. And so I was living on a very tiny, small lake in a very small, tiny cottage with my now wife, Natalie Bacopoulos, also a very talented fiction writer.
And also the one who picked the songs for the show.
who was kind enough to help me with all the music for today, so you can attribute that to her.
Hello, Natalie.
Hello, Natalie. So we were up in this very small cottage, which is a lot like The Shining, but with less space, I like to joke. And isolation is actually not the best. Despite writers pretending to be hermits, many of them are actually quite social people. And so we quite literally jumped at the chance to move to Madison for me to take on this job with Dean. And so for 5 years, we ran this very small independent bookstore in Madison. And it was probably the best education as a writer I could have received in that I was constantly surrounded by books. I was constantly talking to customers about their favorite books, which meant I was being exposed to all sorts of lines of reading and genres that I never would have found on my own because everyone's tastes are so different.
And having to stay up on everything across the board.
Yes, exactly.
And reading all the new releases and what are you going to buy for the shop.
Yep, and when guests came, we had a very strong reading series. You know, so I had the pleasure of introducing everyone from David Sedaris and Studs Terkel to Sherman Alexie and Susan Minot and Laurie Moore and all these wonderful people. And to your question, how did I sort of decide or realize I'd hit the glass ceiling? After all those years of working at the bookstore and becoming very familiar with sort of contemporary fiction and meeting all these wonderful writers and hearing about all these wonderful conferences, I realized that I was selling a lot of other people's work, but not doing a hell of a lot of it myself.
Did you have time? Were you writing some evenings or
yes,
did you have some sort of a routine?
Yeah, we scheduled, we worked very hard on the schedule so that both Dean and I would have certain days of the week off that were sort of our writing days. And to balance
so is Dean
duties.
A writer, too?
Yeah, Dean, okay. His first novel, Please Don't Come Back from the Moon, came out with Harcourt a couple years ago. It's a fantastic novel. And the new one, My American Unhappiness, is coming out next year.
That's a nice title.
Yeah, yeah. We just saw the cover. Looks great.
So a shout-out to Dean
So a shout-out to Dean in Ames, Iowa, where he now works at at Iowa State University, teaching there in their MFA program. Yeah. So we both sort of simultaneously realized that we'd had a good run at the bookstore, and it was time for us to go try to be writers ourselves now that we'd apprenticed ourselves to the craft for so long. And I decided that I wanted to come back to Michigan. There were some people who had come here who I wanted to now work with, and I sort of missed being in Ann Arbor. And so we moved east back here.
Yeah. And who were some of those people, Jeremy?
I really wanted to work with Peter Hodavies. I wanted to, again, work with Eileen Pollack, who was such a great mentor to me. Charlie Baxter was here also, Nick Del Banco. So their whole craft of people I wanted to come back and be a part of this program.
Yeah, and you're still a part of this program in large ways, teaching and then also with Fiction Writers Review. When you were talking about the bookshop, I wondered if that was the connection also with this online review as a place for writers, fiction writers especially, to meet and have ideas and share ideas about fiction writing.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of an online community that you're attempting to build. Is that fair?
Absolutely. Yeah. And the credit goes to our founder, Ann Stemeshkin, who was an MFA graduate from Michigan in 06, I believe.
This is a show, like a shout-out after shout-out show. It
Michigan.
Seems like, hello, Anne.
Exactly. So in one of those classes with Eileen Pollack, one of their assignments was to write a review of new fiction and to look and see what sort of reviews were out there about fiction. And what we discovered was, or what Anne in particular discovered, because this was truly her brainchild, was that there really wasn't a lot happening out there besides a few very isolated places like the New York Times Book Review and only a few pieces each Sunday and the Stray Weekly Review. And many of these reviews had moved from craft-based, thoughtful analysis and reviews of what the writer was attempting to do in this project versus a summary of the plot, you know, or an evaluative thumbs up, thumbs down. And so,
which seems kind of damaging too, very limited. And
exactly. And we were all young writers.
Yeah. Gatekeepers. How would you even get a place in there? Yeah.
It's like, but the old joke about waiting tables, right? You only hire if you have experience, but how does one get experience? And that was absolutely the case too. And that we also wanted to, and she very much wanted to provide a forum where, writers could write their first book reviews with some very close editorial help. People could publish their first interviews. People could, and a site that really promoted emerging writers, whether that meant new writers just coming out of programs, or they meant writers who had been toiling away and had several books but had never quite broken in.
And so that's where your mission is, sort of the main part of the mission.
Yeah,
for these writers.
Definitely sort of two parts, sort of creating this conversation, absolutely, and specifically giving emerging writers and new writers and young writers a place to come, not only for the conversation, but also to publish their first criticism, you know, and not criticism in terms of good, bad, but criticism in terms of this particular point of view choice affects the entire novel in these interesting ways.
Yeah, so always looking through the lens of a particular part of the craft.
Right, and whether someone actually ever buys the book, in a sense, in our opinion, is almost irrelevant in that you should leave a good review, having thought about writing in a new way. Whether you buy the book or not, that's great.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, fingers crossed, absolutely. But we weren't hoping to, you know, create a venue for selling books. But talking about them.
Because Amazon or Borders or even Pals, like where they have the different feedback and different reviews, that would be more of a forum for that.
On their online sites, yeah, exactly.
Yes. Yeah. And do people ever respond to these reviews, Jeremy? Post, start the comments and discussions?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. We have often long comment threads and conversations about people who either are enthusiastically in agreement or didn't quite read the book that way.
Oh, well, great.
But that's healthy. That's what we want.
Yeah, that's exactly what you want. Some community, right? Okay, let's take a short break. Today on Living Writers, we have Jeremiah Chamberlain. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be right back.
Standing on the corner with a nickel or a dime, there used to be a rail car to take you down the line. But too much beer and whiskey to ever be employed. And when I got to Nashville, it was too much soldier's joy. Wasted on the wayside, wasted on the way. If I don't go tomorrow, you know I'm gone today. Back, baby, back in time. I wanna go back when you were mine. Back, baby, back in time. When you were mine.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, you've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel, and today on the program, Jeremiah Chamberlain is here. Jeremy, it's good to have you here.
Thanks. I'm enjoying it.
And so you went to the MFA program.
I did.
And as you've filled us in on. So you're a very busy man because you're also teaching mm-hmm. here, and you're now, as of August this month, 2010, you are the editor-in-chief of Fiction Writers Review, FWR.
Well, editor, yeah. Anne is our editor-in-chief and our founding editor.
Oh, okay.
And
okay.
I moved up into the editor position, yeah. No, it's very exciting. We've had a lot of wonderful growth. You know, as I was saying a minute ago, you know, when Anne originally envisioned this back in the very early winter of 2008 and first started talking to some of us about this as a possibility, about being writers on the site. We were originally envisioning it, or I should say she was originally envisioning it, as definitely being a conversation, but a fairly small conversation among people who knew one another, a way to talk about fiction, share ideas. But the goal was not originally to create this very far-reaching entity.
So what transformed it?
Well, the audience did.
Oh, okay.
Have just found a wonderfully large audience of people who are reading us. I think when we last looked, we had something like 80,000 visitors to the site in 12 months' time. And we're going to things like AWP, the Writers' Conference. And what we found was that as we are publishing the first reviews, or not always first, but often first reviews of people who are in MFA programs, they of course then share the site and their work with their friends, who then of course pass it on to sort of their friends. So despite the fact that we've never had a dime of funding in these 2 years, and it's entirely a labor of love for all of us involved, it's grown from this several dozen writers sharing these ideas, launched in September of 2008.
With
a very strong background of people who had moved through the University of Michigan program, simply because that's who we knew.
But then others were invited to the party.
Absolutely. And the way we want to continue growing and the way we've grown the best has been meeting a friend who then says, oh, I published an essay on this great site, and then having that individual recommend someone to us. So everything has been word of mouth, whether the growth of the site itself to its audience of readers who have stumbled upon us or in the publishing industry, and then also our contributors are definitely, most people come through another contributor who recommends them. I mean, that's not always the case. We are always looking for new contributors. There's a very prominent button on the homepage of the site that says Write For Us. And if you click on that, it takes you right to our submissions page, and you can query us about projects or, you know, send writing samples of your work. So,
and this would be fictionwritersreview.com.
That's correct. Yep, that's the website. Very easy to remember our name and .com. No dots, no spaces. Just Fiction Writers Review. Yep.
And is part of the new mission also to integrate it with the MFA program here at Michigan, Jeremy?
That's been a natural growth, simply that, you know, I'm here, Stemeshkin, our editor-in-chief and founding editor, is now in Columbus, Ohio. She just moved there, so she's working to make contacts and reach out to their program. Our blog editor and assistant editor, Celeste Ng, is in Boston, so she has lots of connections through Grub Street.
Because she teaches fiction there.
She teaches there, exactly. Lee Thomas, who's our managing editor, was originally in San Francisco and wrote for the San Francisco Chronicle and for the New York Times Book Review, and she's now just moved to New York. So editorially, you know, the four of us are bringing people in literally from all four corners of the country. And then,
although there might be an opening out west now, so if
yes.
One of our western listeners.
Right. Well, we did just bring in, as we grow, we've brought in a great writer, Mike Rudin, who's going to be our director of marketing and development.
That's right. That's a new development.
Yep. And he was a writer of ours. And going back for one more Michigan connection, Mike was actually one of the very first students of mine I ever taught here at the University of Michigan 6-7 years ago. And he went on to be a fiction writer himself, but also went into the business world and worked in California in Activision as one of their brand managers.
So has some savvy.
Yeah, some great savvy, some wonderful online connections, and is a very talented both fiction writer and essayist. We've published a number of his wonderful essays on the site. That's part of the reason we wanted to bring him aboard, is because he's been invested and committed to Fiction Writers Review from the beginning. He's been a writer of ours from the beginning, and now he's graciously accepted to sort of help us out with, you know, the side of the growth that we didn't sort of anticipate or expect, you know.
Right. And so there's lots of growth happening.
Yeah.
And you've been, as you mentioned, you were part of AWP last year, mm-hmm. and you've got a panel that's been accepted for the 2011.
Yeah, we're very excited about that.
What's the title of that panel?
Well, the one we did last year was the evolution of the new media, and we did a whole panel with several other journals that are involved with new media, so Waccamaw, Story South, and the Emerging Writers Network, and we talked about the growth of journals online and that shift and how it's affecting both writing and media. And then this year, I'm very proud to be moderating a panel called The Good Review, Criticism in the Age of Book Blogs and Amazon.com. And so I'll have with me some really wonderful, wonderful participants. Charles Baxter, my old mentor, will be there. Stacey Durasmo, who teaches at Columbia and also writes for The Times and Book Forum. Gemma Seif, who's an editor at Harper's. And our own Keith Taylor here, who's written hundreds of wonderful reviews, and especially reviews of poetry and translation, which doesn't get talked about much.
And a lot of those are placed, I think, regularly in the Ann Arbor Observer, mm-hmm. for one place, so everyone locally knows Keith.
Certainly.
Looks to Keith for what's right. the word and new books, especially yeah. poetry.
Mm-hmm. But he writes for the LA Times as well, and writes for a number of places all around the country, yeah.
Yes.
But he's definitely our homegrown hero for all the local listeners.
In so many ways. And then we also have the Business Symposium that's mm-hmm. on deck for later September. Is it the kickoff the 23rd, Jeremy?
I think it's actually Friday the 24th.
Okay.
This is a wonderful day-long symposium that the Department of English is sponsoring. And it's open to the public. It's going to be at Palmer Commons all day on Friday the 24th. It starts at, I think, right at 9 a.m.
Get your coffee.
Yeah, and Davey Rothbart, who's the creator of Found Magazine, is going to sort of kick that off. We've got panels on everything from blogs and advertising to writing in other fields like science and nature. And so the idea is to give both our MFA students and the public and the writing community of Ann Arbor a taste of all the different career paths one can follow with a degree in English if you're an undergraduate student or if you're an MFA student. So
that's very helpful,
it's very
actually.
Helpful. Yeah, there are going to be editors from prominent houses like Norton and Harper's, magazines like Harper's coming in. Agents will be here.
So all the students that are graduating with English degrees, they don't have to go out into the woods and find the cabin and the isolation, perhaps.
Right, exactly. So all of these people will be talking about all the different avenues that exist out there, you know, beyond just getting your BA or your MFA.
Yeah, and so with FWR too, Jeremy, so some of the current MFA students are also already starting to contribute as well. You don't have to graduate from the program to be
absolutely not
part of it.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. We have a lot of our current MFAs I work closely with to encourage them to sit down with our visiting writers. We have wonderful, as many people in Ann Arbor know, an amazing reading series, the Zell Visiting Writers series. And if you visit the University of Michigan MFA website, you can see all of the 2010 and 2011 schedule. And we have just a phenomenal
and many
lineup.
Of them, many of them will be on the program, too.
Oh,
so you'll
wonderful.
Be hearing,
absolutely.
Hearing them.
Yeah.
But then you can go and see them in person,
yeah,
too.
You can see them at the readings. And what we do is we have such a wonderful opportunity in this writing community for our MFA students to sit down with one of those visiting writers, which is a rare opportunity to talk with Mary Gateskill or talk with, you know, Daniel Alarcon or ZZ Packer or, you know, whomever happens to be visiting. So I try to facilitate as much as I can. I work with Megan Levod as the assistant director of the program, and
she's great,
wonderful
yeah.
help to us, and has been supportive of Fiction Writers Review from the beginning. Because, you know, again, it's we want it to be a collaborative project that grows in the directions that our contributors want it to grow. So, if a writer comes to me and says, "I really want to interview this person and know their work well," I've been following them mm-hmm. as a young writer, I might not know who they are, but that's not the goal of the site. The goal is to have it reflect the tastes of all of our contributors, which now range, I think, nearly 60 in almost every state and even overseas.
It's quite a packet of people if you print
it
out like one crazy interviewer did.
Oh, yes, so, I see that. Impressive.
Yeah. No, it's great. The pieces.
Yeah. And we definitely are starting to find particular programs where, again, because it is so much word of mouth, someone will write for us, and then they'll recommend one of their colleagues. So, you know, we have several writers at Old Dominion in Virginia. One person wrote me, Mary Westbrook, out of the blue after she read an essay I had published in Glimmer Train, actually, not even about Fiction Writers Review. Eventually, we struck up a conversation.
Was that the one where it's workshop is not for
it's
you?
Not for you, exactly.
It's a great title.
Yeah. Thank you.
And a good piece.
Thanks. That grew out of my teaching. I mean, I think the hard thing about workshop for anyone who's gone through it is that if you do it right, you want to invest time, you want to invest energy, and you want to give a lot to your fellow workshop members. So it's discouraging, to say the least, when, you know, when your turn comes up, to get marginal comments at best, or, you know, no comments whatsoever. And so my students will come to my office and say, you know, "I'm very frustrated that I've been putting in my time and investing in this workshop, and then I feel like I got jilted when it was my turn," and they're very upset about it. And so I said, well, you know, where the real learning comes from is actually the process of having to think through somebody else's story or somebody else's essay, and that might be where you learn more, actually, than the comments that you get on your own work.
So did you come to that as a teacher when you were teaching writing, Jeremy? Or was that something that you thought through when you were in the MFA program workshops?
Definitely in the teaching.
Okay.
In the teaching, yeah.
It's funny how that's sort of transformative,
yes,
isn't it?
Yeah,
like
absolutely.
To see writing in a completely different
way. Very different way. Absolutely. So no, it came out of a number of disgruntled office hour visits with students who I had to assure that, despite the fact that they hadn't received the type of feedback they were looking for, that they were still indeed learning.
Right. You know, I wondered about when you, with the reviews, you said you're also encouraging experimental reviews, like there's traditional reviews as well as, and I wondered what sort of shape do you imagine, or is there already an example?
Well, interestingly enough, we were talking about Mike Rudin earlier. He's publishing, or we're publishing his review of the new Best of the Web anthology, which DeZank Books puts out each year.
DeZank, another locally homegrown.
Yeah, one of the
Steve McGillis.
Yeah, Steve Gillis.
Oh, Steve Gillis. I'm trying to make you
Dan
Scottish. Steve, sorry about that.
Steve Gillis and Dan Wickett founded DeZank in 2006. And prior to that, Steve was a fiction writer with a number of books out, very well received. And Dan was the founder of the Emerging Writers Network. So they came together and created DeZank, which is both a charitable organization. They do a lot of writers in the school programs. They fund scholarships to places like Bear River Writers Conference.
And they're publishing books.
And they have a writers conference.
And they're publishing books.
And they have their other aspect of their program is that they're a wonderful, perhaps one of the premier independent publishers. They have more than 50 titles out right now. They have several imprints. And one of their books, Laura Vandenberg's collection, What the World Will Look Like When All the Water Leaves Us, which is a beautiful title and a
yes.
wonderful book, was just nominated for the Frank O'Connor Short Story Award, which is probably the biggest award you can get as a fiction writer.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, and it's an international award. And interestingly enough, this year, 6 of the 7 finalists are American writers, which is
That's USA.
Right.
And also,
didn't mean to pitch nationalism, but DeZank is one of the great indie presses out there, and also doing wonderful nonprofit work. And they publish Best of the Web every year. And Mike Rudin is publishing a wonderful sort of three-dimensional book review of that, because all the writing in their anthology is online and visual. He has incorporated all these great images.
Oh, that's great. He's responding in kind.
Exactly.
Oh,
right.
That's great.
So we're excited to publish that probably in early September, late August.
Oh, that's wonderful. And yeah. Then also like a quick mention, Peter Marcus, also a friend of the show.
Absolutely.
His books out with Dezenc.
Bob or Man on Boat. Yep.
Yes. Yep. So we're going to take a short break. We'll be back to talk more with Jeremy Chamberlain. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers, Brian Delaney manning the engineering booth. We'll be back. Back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel, and you're listening to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. Thank goodness you are. Glad to have you out there, and glad to have you in here.
Thanks.
Jeremy.
I'm enjoying the talk very much.
Today, Jeremiah Chamberlain is here in studio, editor of Fiction Writers Review, fiction writer in his own right. You also are you have a series, Indie Bookstores, mm-hmm. series in Poets and Writers Magazine.
Right, yeah.
And we'll get to that. But first, let's talk about some Bulgarian emerging writers,
okay.
Jeremy.
Well, I had the great opportunity to be selected as one of the fellows to participate in the Sozopol Fiction Seminar in Bulgaria. And we were talking earlier about everything Fiction Writers Review is trying to do. One of our big missions is trying to connect writers, right? Trying to sort of give a forum for emerging writers, whatever that might be.
And
I
translators?
Think we're all emerging writers.
We're emerging.
Yeah, emerging, swimming, trying to keep afloat, treading
living.
Water.
Living, yeah.
Exactly, living. And another organization besides Dezenc, which I admire and which is has a similar mission as well, is the Elizabeth Kostova Foundation, which was founded by one of our former MFAs, Elizabeth Kostova, who wrote the sensational New York Times bestselling historian, and then most recently The Swan Thieves.
And she was on the program for The Swan Thieves.
Yeah, terrific. It's a fantastic book.
And read at Nicola's Books.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, wonderful crowd for that reading.
Huge crowd.
Yeah,
I think
it.
They had to be, I don't know, I think the doors couldn't shut.
Yeah. Well, in 2006, when Elizabeth was touring abroad for The Historian, she was meeting a lot of writers in Bulgaria who were incredibly talented and very driven and very passionate about their work. But there are no resources. I mean, we're very blessed. We've been talking about the MFA program here. We've been talking about places like the Interlochen Arts Academy for high school students. We've been talking about grants and awards and things like that. Well, that doesn't exist in Bulgaria. They're the poorest country in the EU in terms of GDP. MFA programs don't exist. Scholarships and fellowships and opportunities don't exist. So those people who write are doing so, you know, on the side while holding other jobs and, you know, as it is for the majority of writers in this country, not something that you make a living at. It's a passion and it's an art. So what Elizabeth found is that there really was no support for these people. So she pledged a large portion of her foreign royalties to start this foundation. And then she subsequently worked doing fundraising with everyone from the U.S. Embassy to the Bulgarian Ministry of Culture and a number of organizations as well. The Soros Foundation, I think, donated in their first year. And it's created this foundation that does a number of things. The primary mission is to create connections between writers in Bulgaria and the U.S., or English-speaking countries, I should say. They sponsor a translation prize. And then every summer, they have a week-long writing seminar in Sizopol, which is on the Black Sea. And it's just one of the most gorgeous places I've ever been in my life.
Is it the Bulgarian Riviera?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. It looks a lot like it would be reminiscent of the Mediterranean in that there are red tile roofs on the buildings and sort of whitewashed buildings and cobblestone streets and a very quaint, gorgeous. And it was always a writer's retreat, visual writer's retreat. And she was there visiting with her family because her husband actually is Bulgarian, so she also has a personal connection.
Visual artists, Jeremy, the painters, and okay.
Because it's such a gorgeous place with beautiful light and amazing landscapes, it's always been a home for visual artists. And she was with her friend Svetlio, who is a publisher of Bulgarian literary works. And she said to him, Svetlio, why do these visual artists get to have this wonderful, wonderful place here? You know, we should start a writer's, you know, seminar here. And Svetlio, as she recounts being Svetlio, says, sure, why not? Not thinking about, you know, what that would entail. He's just enthusiastic and positive and this wonderful, wonderful guy and great champion of literature. And so, by goodness, they did. And now this year it will be the fourth annual seminar. So I had the great pleasure of going in 2009, last summer, for that week. And the way the seminar works is that they select five native English-speaking writers and five Bulgarian writers, and they bring them together for that week, along with publishers, translators, editors, agents, both from the U.S., Europe, and elsewhere.
Wow, how amazing.
It is amazing. And so you spend an entire week just deeply absorbed in writing and the culture of writing. And
did you also then begin to work on some translating projects with one of the Bulgarian members of the cohort? Or
I didn't directly so much, though all of our work was translated, which was a very interesting and moving experience. We were paired with a Bulgarian writer throughout the seminar who we sort of spent time with and worked with. And one of the final presentations was that a Bulgarian writer, your partner, would read your work in Bulgarian and you would read his or her work in English. And we would each read the same work. So I would read my story in English and then he would read my story in Bulgarian and vice versa. And it was really a fantastic and moving experience to, A, hear your own work in another language and to sort of, you know, try to follow along and where someone is laughing, thinking, oh, are they laughing at that part? Because, of course, I don't speak Bulgarian and, you know, none of the English participants did. You don't have to have an interest, per se, in Bulgarian.
But I'm sure you leave with one.
You absolutely do. And I think that's the greatest benefit of the seminar is that you leave with an entirely different vision of what writing is like in another culture in another country. And I've kept in touch with many of the people since. Some of them have written or are going to be writing for Fiction Writers Review. In fact, this fall we'll be publishing a photo essay by a number of the fellows this year who all wrote in to me and sent pictures. And so we're going to have that on Fiction Writers Review website. But yeah, it's a wonderful program. And they're, of course, trying to expand that reach. And I believe the application process is usually in the late winter and late February, early March. But if you go to the website ekf.bg, Elizabeth Kostova Foundation.bg is what the initials stand for, ekf.bg. There's a lot of information about all the different things they're doing with that program.
Well, that's great. Thank you for mentioning that, because what a wonderful opportunity. I'm so glad that you were there, Jeremy.
Yeah, it was really awe-inspiring.
Now, is that when you wrote your story that won the... No? No?
Oh, the Glimmer Train story. No, yeah. That was... A different
topic.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, let's. I wanted to ask you before mm-hmm. Later on we're going to hear a piece
sure.
of one of your stories. I hope. And but in the meantime, you also are writing and doing interviews mm-hmm. for the series for Poets and Writers Magazine.
Yeah, and that's been really, really exciting work for me because as I was saying earlier, I really felt like bookstores raised me as a writer. You know, like if I have a debt to pay, in many ways it is to those independent booksellers who taught me to be a writer and taught me what it meant to be an author who visited stores and to understand the relationship between readers and writers and how intimate that bond is and how important bookstores are.
And how, if we don't recognize that and tend it, they disappear. Like mm-hmm. we've just had our loss of Shaman Drum
right.
Here in Ann Arbor. So.
Yeah, and they were part of the reason that, you know, Carl Port and his wonderful dedication to bookselling in this community was part of the reason I started the series. But the other reason was also that students would come to me. I've been teaching now long enough that my students are actually graduated and going out into the world, and some of them, many of them, are great, talented writers and want to pursue writing as a career. And near around graduation time, they will always come and say, okay, now what? where do I go next? Because I've always been very adamant about repeating what Eileen told me, which was, you know, until you've hit the glass ceiling of your own abilities, don't go into an MFA program too soon before you're ready. It's a wonderful opportunity, but you've got to time it right. And it's really easy to just want to go straight from school into a new academic program because the big world is scary out there. But, you know, I would say, you know, go out there and live a little bit. You know, Mark Strand's great quote, you know, how vain it is to sit down to write when you haven't stood up to live. And so I would always say, go out there. And I would always say, go work at a bookstore. You know, it worked for me. Obviously, I'm a little biased. But I would say, you know, go shelve books, put your hands on them, learn, you know, who the authors are who are writing good work these days.
Now it's go
but
and
now I can't.
See some Kindles.
Well, that's the problem, is that...
You shouldn't be so bitter,
should I? No. Increasingly, it was harder for me to make that recommendation because they would say, oh, I'd love to, but there's nowhere to do it. And it's especially when Shaman Drum closed because I couldn't say, well, look, right across the street there's a great place, you know, put your application in there.
There's still Borders.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
Nicholas.
And
lots
absolutely.
Of great used bookshops.
Tons.
Don Trader,
right.
David's.
Right. But we've just had such a
Agatha's.
Loss. You know, I mean, in the 15 years since I started working, 70% of all independent bookstores have gone out of business, which is a shocking number. And there has been a slight turnaround the last year. We saw some positive numbers in January and February of bookstores, you know, reopening and opening in unexpected places. So that's
well,
really hopeful.
Well, if they
hopeful.
Can be community spaces, if
exactly.
somehow that can be foregrounded and people know that's part of the mission of
right.
the shop, not just to get the best bargain on the book, but
right.
for other reasons.
Yeah.
I had students that I took to Westside Bookshop, and they didn't understand that it was a used bookshop. They thought that you could just look at them, but not... because they hadn't been to one somehow.
Right. Yeah, so we're very lucky to live in a book town that has Nicholas and has Borders and has Westside Bookshop and the Dawn Treader and David's and all these wonderful, wonderful places. And I don't by any means mean to just sort of point to Shaman Drum. But it's true that all across the country we've been losing these because a lot of those students will go home to where their parents live or where they grew up. Rather than staying in Ann Arbor for a few years to find themselves or move to another city with some friends. So I wrote to the editor of Poets and Writers, and I said, hey, I used to work in a bookstore, and it was really important in me becoming a writer. Would you be interested in me writing an essay about that experience and about how independent booksellers are not just important to the community and as a browsing space and a way for readers and writers to meet one another, but that... The people who are always forgotten in that equation when we say we've had a loss in the community are the people behind the cash registers, that so many of them are young writers, aspiring writers themselves, who are now out in the street, so to speak.
Yeah, and outstanding readers, people who've devoted their lives
terrific.
To reading.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And so he said, yeah, that sounds interesting. Why don't you write this essay? And so I wrote the essay, and after it had been accepted for publication, I was thinking about it, and I said, you know, it would be great. Let's think about this essay as a launch pad for a whole series, because as I was working in the bookstore, writers would come through and I would always say to them, oh, well, where are you off to next on your tour? And they would say, oh, I'm so excited because I'm going to Square Books in Oxford, Mississippi. It's one of the best bookstores in the country. And so as a bookseller, I had all these visions of these amazing bookstores around the country that I'd never been to. And
Powell's in Portland, Oregon.
Right. So it's a bit of a self-serving project, I must admit, in that my pitch to the editor was, let me travel around the country and visit the best bookstores in America and talk to those owners and community people about why their bookstore is one of the ones that has made it through a very difficult last decade, and what they're trying to do about the future, because we make jokes about the Kindle, but, you know, it's not going away. And it doesn't necessarily have to. I think that those things can very well coexist, but that's how that at least got started.
Well, that sounds okay. Let's take a short break, and then we'll hear more when we come back from Jeremiah Chamberlain. I'm T. Hetzel. You're listening to Living Writers. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel, and today on the program, Jeremy Chamberlain is here. Jeremy, so your grand tour of independent bookshops.
Right. So, you know, as I was working at Canterbury, you know, I think it's natural as for any young writer to envision their first book, to envision their first book cover, to envision their first author tour. And so that had always been in my mind also as a writer myself. And I'm not just a teacher and an editor. And, you know, so I started thinking, well, what are the stores that I've always wanted to go to, or what are the stores that I know are wonderful, wonderful places that I would love to have the opportunity to spend a couple of hours sitting down with the owners and really asking them how they got into the business and why it matters. So I started off in Square Books in Oxford, Mississippi. I took a road trip down there. Richard Howarth, the owner, was very gracious. He actually was the mayor of Oxford for two terms. And that's one of the great sort of bastions of Southern literature and just a wonderful, amazing store. Faulkner, of course, his house and his grave are there. So it's a very literary city. Even the local restaurant has all of the names of the meals named after authors. So if you go to Big Bad Barbecue, you can, you know, get a Smonk burger after Tom Franklin's novel, or you can get a Hein Lonesome breakfast, you know. So I went to Square Books in Oxford. I also visited Powell's in Portland, largest bookstore in the world, an entire city block. Michael Powell was generous enough to take me also to their warehouses where they do all the online business. So very fascinating to get to talk to him, because he was online long before Amazon was. You know, he really saw the future there. And then I traveled to Women and Children First in Chicago, talked to Linda Bubon and Anne Christofferson, who run that store, and there's a feminist bookshop that's been in business for more than 30 years, so we really talked about their role in the community, and then...
It's a great name for a bookshop.
Women and Children First, absolutely.
Yeah, because it's also like the lifeboat thing, too.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then in the current issue, I traveled to Milwaukee to Boswell Book Company, Daniel Golden's store there that was sort of resurrected after the Schwartz chain went out of business after about 80 years, and he's making a go of it. He just finished his first year in business. So he talked about what it's like to open a bookstore sort of in these tough economic times. And through the rest of the year, in each issue, there'll be a new store I visit and publish.
And when you're talking with these owners, Jeremy, mm-hmm. are you, is it usually a couple of hours, and do you have a tape recorder going, or what's your method for interviewing before it becomes a print interview?
Sure. I do. I take actually two recorders because on more than one occasion I've had one of them die. First one ran out of tape or ran out of batteries, and then the other one, a digital recorder, filled up. So, yeah, I do. I sit down and we talk for anywhere from an hour to 2 hours, which if you've ever transcribed an interview, you realize is a lot of work. But it's fun work to sort of revisit those conversations, because when you're in the process of talking to someone, you're trying to let them sort of guide the conversation, follow along, nudge them, ask questions, but it's very different when you step back and actually listen to the conversation that you had rather than sort of being in the midst of it.
And how do you encourage them to say some things that, I don't know, were there ever moments where you felt like, oh, you wanted to know more, but they were reticent, or do you have, I don't know, any strategies?
Right. Yeah. I think that, you know, I was actually just talking to Linda Swanson Davies, who's the editor of Glimmer Train, which is one of my favorite publications, and not just because he just published me. I started submitting my work to them in 1997.
You've loved them for a long time.
I said to her when they finally took my first story this last year, I said, Linda, I've been entering contests at Glimmer Train for 13 years, and I've had a couple of honorable mentions, but I keep plugging away at it. And she said, oh, we know. We've been watching you. So I don't know if she was just being polite or not. But, you know, I was talking to her about the interviewing process and how different it is when you're actually having a conversation with someone versus, say, over the phone or on email. All those are definitely, you know, forms that are sort of necessitated due to distance and time and space. But really nothing is like the surprises that come up in a conversation is. So I don't know if I have any particular strategies other than letting the person I'm talking to know that I'm not out to surprise them or I'm not out to get them on anything they might say, that I truly am simply interested in hearing what they think about the world and how they see that world. And then I see my job as taking that and then finding a way to relay it to the reader so that the audience feels like they've been in the midst of that conversation with that person or sitting at the table beside the two of us.
And when you present it, when you edit it, Jeremy, we were talking briefly, you have a method where you keep the same chronology with your, even if there's parts that you're not including in the text version.
Yeah, I mean, let's be honest, an interview is a literary document. If we were to transcribe the entire 2 hours I spoke to someone, it would be 21 single-space pages and something like 14,000 words. An average interview in a magazine is 2,000 words. So how do you go from 14,000 words to 2,000? I don't believe in rearranging the chronology. Just insofar as I want to be sort of true to the development of the conversation. We started here, and then we ended here, and you followed us along the way. Sometimes I'll have to remove 6-8 pages in the middle where we went off on a wonderful digression, but unfortunately just due to space and time constraints in the magazine, we're not allowed to see all of it. But I do think that having a few sort of ethical decisions about things like chronology, I try to stick to those as best I can.
Yeah, with so many words.
Yeah,
right?
While still capturing something. I think what's most important is capturing a sense of the person's voice and a sense
essence.
Of their personality.
Yes, yes.
Absolutely.
And can we hear some of your fiction, Jeremy?
Sure. This is the story that Glimmer Train did just publish. It's called What We Can. It won their Family Matters contest last year. Okay, What We Can. When the phone rang, my wife and I were slouched on the living room sofa, remnants of wine in our glasses, the television a dull glaze. The turkey had been stripped from its bones and the last of the dishes set to soak in the sink. I would say that the house smelled of small comforts like candle wax and nutmeg and cranberries, which it did, but this was barely 2 months after my surgery, and my body wasn't aware of much beyond trying to get my legs to feel right again. "Don't get it," my wife said. "Let the answering machine pick up." But I hoisted myself off the couch and headed for the cordless in the kitchen. I assumed it was my folks, who'd thought they should spend the holiday with my dad's aging parents in Indianapolis that year. Or perhaps my wife's father, who always went with his new wife to her mother's condo in Florida. Or maybe my brother across the country calling from his girlfriend's place on Bainbridge Island. Or even my wife's brother and his wife, Abby, who were spending their first Thanksgiving at home in Wisconsin with the new baby. Instead, it was my mother-in-law, whom we'd just seen. When I answered, she said my name as if she were surprised to hear my voice. Then there was a river of noise, and Michael, her cousin from the Ukraine who'd been renting a room in her basement for the last years, 3 years, took the phone. He told me that the car had died on the drive back from our house. "This car is dead. I'm driving the no lights, no nothing." Another wash of sound drowned out his voice, and I realized around the side of the freeway that the noise was from the traffic surging by. He checked the wiring, the battery connections, but nothing. He couldn't understand why the car had quit. They were on M14 somewhere near Ford Road, halfway back to Dearborn Heights. My wife's mother came back on the phone. "We called AAA and they're sending a truck, but they won't let us all ride in the cab. They say they can only take two because of seatbelts, but what are we supposed to do, leave Bob on the side of the road? Goddamn fascists, they'd rather let an old woman die than break some stupid rule." My mother-in-law was an inveterate writer of letters to the editor, and I felt sure that the Detroit News would soon be receiving an opinion piece. A decade earlier, we'd had to repeatedly call the cable company to get her service turned back on after a long-standing error in her billing, which she attributed to age discrimination, had prompted her to call Comcast and threaten to blow up their building. She was not a woman who tolerated injustices. "We'll be there right away," I reassured her. "I'm sorry," she said. "It's not right. You made such a nice dinner. You shouldn't have to come out." I assured her it was no problem. We would be there in a few minutes.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, the opening
I can see,
page or two.
Well, from that opening, I can see why it was a prize winner.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind.
Well, thanks so much for being on the program today.
It was terrific. Thank you, too. I had a great time.
And so for people who want to get involved with FWR, Fiction Writers Review,
yeah,
can
please
go to fictionwriterswriview.com.
Yeah, fictionwritersreview.com is the site. Write for us. We hope you'll read us and become part of our audience and our participants.
And check out the Glimmer Train, where you can read the rest of the story, Jeremy's story.
Get the Glimmer Train in the summer 2010 issue.
Wonderful. So I bet people will be running out the door to get a copy. Glimmer Train, it's going to spike. Yeah. They can thank us later. Thanks again to Brian Delaney for engineering. Thanks to everyone listening out there in Ann Arbor and beyond. I'd like to give a shout out to Carl, the extraordinary and spectacular. Soon there'll be a website for living writers with some of the shows, the archives available. Thank you, Carl. And also a hello to Libby at Fifth and Liberty, who's keeping peace activism alive and well here in Ann Arbor. Thanks again to Jeremy Chamberlain. I'm T. Hetzel. Until next time.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, August 11th, 2010. In New York, I'm Doran Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, aid agencies call for more assistance as the